on 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to Laura Fox for guiding us through the afternoon. It's Pancake Tuesday, the 1st of March, and this is Game On. Coming up today, more and more Ukrainian sports stars answers a call to defend their country.
We hope the Russians take the decision, move back to Russia. They nothing to find here in our home, but I see so many people. We're everybody proud of our army of Ukrainian who defend our city, defend our homes, defend our family.
Yes, Vitali Klitschko there, former heavyweight world champion and mayor of Kyiv. This evening, we will also have Paul Curry, Mark Langdon on all things association football. Plus, we've Niall Moran on Allianz League Hurling. And if that wasn't enough, we'll also turn our attention to golf and we'll hear from Gary Murphy and Greg Allen on Shane Lowry's near win at the Honda Classic.
Game on 2FM.
If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FNM even. So Shane, more and more Ukrainian sports stars are showing the admirable trait of defending their nation.
Yes, absolutely. We heard from Vitali Klitschko there at the top of the show. And I know yesterday we kind of gave a brief run through in terms of how sport is responding to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And it is a developing story, developing by the hour, let alone by the day. A couple of headlines, Ruby. Ukrainian tennis player Sergei Stakhovsky says he hopes he will not have to use the gun he's been given after signing up to help his nation's defence against the Russian invasion. Boxer Vasily Lomachenko, a three-weight champion, is another sports star to join Ukraine's reserve forces and has been photographed with a rifle. Heavyweight boxing champion Alexander Usyk is also reported to have signed up. In terms of sporting bodies, the Winter Paralympics, a decision about banning Russian athletes from the 2022 Winter Olympics will be made tomorrow. Afterwards, confirmed the full Ukraine squad will take part in Beijing. World Athletics are the latest to bar Russian and Belarusian athletes from competition. Athletes from both countries were barred from all competitions by governing body World Athletics earlier today, actually just before we came on air. Moscow have been stripped of the Karate Premier League hosting rights. The International Chess Federation has also reacted by announcing that the flags of Russia and Belarus will not be displayed and the anthems of these countries will not be played in international events. Likewise hockey, likewise swimming as well, where there were junior championships set to be played there. And the International Judo Federation suspended Vladimir Putin as honorary president. The Taekwondo Federation has also decided to withdraw his ninth Dan honorary black belt, one which was awarded to him back in 2013. So yeah, wide ranging, and in football as well, because I know, Ruby, we're going to get on to football first. German coach Marcus Gisdol has quit his job as coach of Russian soccer club Lokomotiv Moscow in protest at the invasion. He said, "I cannot stand on the training field in Moscow coaching the players, demanding professionalism, and a couple of kilometres away orders are being issued which bring great suffering to an entire people." Shakhtar Donetsk have also evacuated their Brazilian players to Romania following the invasion. The Ukrainian Premier League club worked with UEFA to move 12 players away from the conflict, which continues to escalate across the country. There were reports as well of Moldovan champion Sheriff Tiraspol, their manager Yuri Vernidub, enlisting in the reserve army and going back to Ukraine as well. And finally, Ruby, I suppose this is where we'll start our conversation on football, because it was reported today and he gave an interview and it was quite interesting and very upsetting as well. Former Liverpool striker Andrei Voronin has quit his coaching role at Dynamo Moscow by mutual consent. Voronin had been the assistant manager with Dynamo for the last 2 years after ending his playing days there, but the Russian invasion of Ukraine compelled him to flee the country. And he said, "We got out of Moscow before it was completely blocked, but we couldn't land in Dusseldorf, so we flew via Amsterdam. My father, my mother-in-law, my wife and children are here now. The little ones went to the German school in Moscow, but school doesn't matter now. I've been unwell for 4 days, really bad. When I see all the pictures from my homeland, when I see the news, it's all as unreal as a movie, but a horror film. I have hardly any words left." So similar to yesterday in terms of catching up on the developing story. It's all happening. And even today, Ruby, Thomas Tuchel, I think, was speaking in the press as well. I know he was peppered with questions on, I suppose, his opinion of all things that's happening. Obviously, Roman Abramovich owns Chelsea, and Tuchel's in a difficult position. And I suppose let's start off our football chat and segue into that by hearing the thoughts of Thomas Tuchel.
This is about sports, and there are a lot of more important things out there. And still, we have the we still there's a huge distraction now going on, and we are worried. But at the end, still, we try to create an atmosphere to come to work and focus on our work, which is our passion. So we are very, 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 very grateful and very privileged to have it. And we will, and it's not that big a problem. But of course, I think that everybody in Europe more or less has like, has some noise in his head that nobody likes, and that it's maybe the same for you. But still, you try to do your job as good as possible, and that's the same for us.
Hi, Thomas. Just on how passionately you spoke a moment ago about the horrors of war. How much do you hope that the owner is using any?
No, listen. You have to stop. I'm not a politician. You have to stop. Honestly, I can only repeat it, and I even feel bad to repeat it because I never experienced war. So even to talk about it, I feel bad because I'm very privileged. I sit here in peace. And I do the best I can, but you have to stop asking me these questions. I have no answers for you.
Well, that is a very awkward situation for Thomas Tuchel to be in, and Mark Langdon joins us on the line. Mark, I can probably sense his frustration, and he's right. He's never witnessed war, and he sits there in peace. He most certainly doesn't have the answers.
No, he doesn't. I mean, I feel, though, that he's going to be asked those questions. He's paid ultimately by Roman Abramovich. Maybe these are the type of questions that should be asked, you know, when he was appointed, and sort of, you know, questioning that. I mean, Eddie Howe had to face similar questions when he was brought in different circumstances. But at Newcastle, you know, about the paymasters. And I think that Thomas Tuchel was, you know, he's been left to sort of hang out to dry, hasn't he, really, by the powers that be at Chelsea. Nobody else wants to front up and ask and answer those questions at the moment. And so, you know, as the most, I suppose, sort of the figurehead of the club, he's sort of put out there, to answer some very difficult questions. Maybe it needs somebody higher up. I mean, obviously Abramovich is not going to speak, but maybe it needs somebody else at Chelsea to come in and, you know, answer some of those questions. Because if Thomas Tuchel is only thinking about football, there needs to be somebody at Chelsea that is capable, I think, of answering those questions, particularly after what happened at the weekend with Abramovich seemingly handing over some kind of control of the club. I mean, I mean, Thomas Tuchel's living in a dreamland if he thinks that any reporters turning up there this week to ask him about the Luton game tomorrow. I mean, it's just, that's unrealistic, isn't it, I think?
Well, could the same questions therefore not be asked of every player in Chelsea who are being paid by Roman Abramovich too?
Yeah, I think so. And whenever it's just that, of course, they're not being, they're not having to go sort of pre-match press conferences. It's always the manager that kind of is obligated to go to those, and it gives the journalist the opportunity to ask the questions. I think, why not? I mean, there was a brilliant piece in The Guardian at the weekend by Barney Roney, just sort of asking how culpable we all are in terms of this and sport washing asking more questions about why people are involved in sport in the first place. And so, maybe that's something for all of us to think about as we move sort of forward and try to move forward from this. And, you know, whenever the players are asked, they always give the stock answer of, you know, they don't know enough about it. You know, they're only concentrating on football. And, yeah, that is what, you know, it's ultimately what they're paid to do is to play and to think about football. But I think it's important that somebody at Chelsea or any of the clubs really is able to answer some of these questions when things become difficult. And, you know, at the moment that there's a vacuum right at the very top at Chelsea, and that is causing problems for Thomas Tuchel, who, like I say, it's unrealistic for him to turn up to a press conference at the moment and, you know, chat about who the right back might be against Luton or, you know, their hopes for the FA Cup. It's just not going to happen. And, you know, like maybe it's a Bruce Buck type or somebody at Chelsea to step forward, because their statements that they've offered up over the weekend were, you know, they were quite dramatic, but they were lacking in detail, weren't they?
Could you see any Chelsea fans voting with their feet and abstaining from attending Stamford Bridge or even going to that Luton game?
No, I don't. There might be sort of little pockets of fans that sort of have got some kind of questions, but, you know, football, it tends to get quite tribal very quickly, and no, I wouldn't expect any. Most fans sort of are able to separate off field and on field, you know, quite easily. And I think we've seen that a number of times over the years. So I wouldn't expect that. And if anything, it will kind of almost, you know, I mean, sort of galvanise the supporters to be even more behind the club. That's generally what happens when you get issues, much less serious than this. But, you know, when you get any kind of issues in football, it tends to just sort of, you know, make the fans even more protective.
Well, I suppose we can put that question to a Chelsea fan, because we have former professional footballer Paul Curry, who indeed, as much as you love the League of Ireland, you also have a bit of a soft spot for Chelsea. Would it put you off? Because, I mean, for Thomas Tuchel, understandably getting frustrated, but on the flip side of that, considering the ownership of Chelsea, and Mark mentioned sports washing and so on, I mean, if you lie down with the devil, you wake up in hell.
Yeah, I think what Marcus said there is spot on. I think it needs clarity and it needs a statement from the club, whether it be Peter Cech, whether it be Bruce Buck, or even Mariana. I'm not even going to try to pronounce her second name, but a very close relationship with Roman Abramovich. She's also, you know, Russian-Canadian. I think somebody like that coming out with a bit of clarity for everybody involved in the football club would be good. Would it stop me from going over to Chelsea? It's a very good question. I come from a family of diehard Chelsea fans, and they love going over. They love the, you know, the atmosphere of Stamford Bridge, the camaraderie amongst the fans. Potentially poses a question to certain fans about whether or not they would go over, but I think I agree with Mark in that it sometimes galvanises football fans to rally around the club and actually, you know, try help the club move in the right direction. So I don't think in the short term, if things were to escalate and maybe there was even more confusion around the whole situation coming out and Abramovich's connections, then potentially. But I think for the meantime, Shane, probably not.
Mark, Chelsea are obviously playing away to Luton tomorrow night, and what we didn't get from Thomas Tuchel's press conference today was the long list of injuries he has.
It's been a difficult season, I think, for Chelsea in terms of injuries. They've played a lot of games in a lot of different competitions. I think that they've been impacted by COVID as well, and maybe some long COVID in some situations. And I think Thomas Tuchel has said himself that he's maybe played players when they weren't 100% fit, and then obviously they've had the cup final on Sunday. They picked up some injuries in that game as well. Azpilicueta had to come off, didn't he? Being one of those, and you know, it's a long hard slog for someone like Thiago Silva to play 120 minutes you know, in cup final, then penalties as well. I mean, he has got a good squad. I mean, that's probably a bit of an understatement. It's a very strong squad, but I think it's been stretched for a lot of this season, Ruby, and that it's not an excuse, but I think it is sort of a reason as to why they're as far off the sort of Premier League pace, the sort of title pace that Man City and Liverpool are setting. In terms of competitions, I think they have to take the FA Cup pretty seriously. So while there will be some changes for sure, I still expect it to be a pretty strong team, because Luton are in fine form, and you know, you wouldn't want to take them too lightly, I wouldn't have thought.
So it's very, very interesting when, I suppose, you're hearing all the different angles and the seriousness of it all, Paul. And then we move on to our next story, and you look at it from Everton looking for an apology over VAR. Now, listen, I know there's so much money at stake in the Premier League, and they're in a very difficult position now because I know Burnley are playing Leicester this evening, and if Burnley get a point, they'll go above Everton. Everton go into the relegation zone, and if Burnley win, they go up to 16th ahead of Leeds as well. So Everton did get their apology, but I suppose it pales in comparison when you've got such other matters at play. But I mean, originally I was thinking, cry me a river, Frank Lampard. Like, you know, decisions go against you. But was it right they did get the apology?
It's laughable, Shane. It's absolutely laughable. I don't understand why the referee's body has had to come out and offer the apology to Everton. Everybody associated with the game, anybody who watches the game, can blatantly see that it's a stonewall penalty and it should have been given. And Everton were very unfortunate not to come away with a point from that game. But what does the apology offer Everton, you know, what does that mean going forward? Is it a case that they get a decision in the next game, or there's something to even things out? It just doesn't make too much sense to me. You're better off just kind of wiping the slate clean and getting on to the next game. They've got huge concerns within Everton with regards to where they sit in the league, and like you mentioned, if Burnley were to draw tonight, that would drop them into the bottom three. So maybe it's a distraction and try deviate the attention away from where they sit in the Premier League, and maybe try get people to rally around the club and everybody kind of against the mentality. But why the referees association and the body have to come out and offer an apology is pretty ridiculous when it's so blatantly obvious that it was a penalty. I just don't see what it offers Everton going forward.
Mark, does that leave the Premier League open anyway, seeing as the referee body have admitted they were wrong? You don't rarely hear that.
You don't. I mean, I tend to agree, though, that it's a pretty ridiculous situation, and one, you know, where do you go next from that? You know, if another referee makes a mistake next week, do they have to apologise? If, you know, a linesman gets something wrong, has he got to come out? I mean, it should have been a penalty. I think that even the VAR team on the night have admitted that, you know, they maybe, you know, should have given the penalty. You know, how many times have Everton lost this season? Their players don't come. You know, I saw Andre Gomez give an absolutely horrendous performance for Everton at Southampton a few weeks ago. He doesn't have to come out on Twitter and apologise for the amount of times he gave the ball away, or the amount of times a midfielder ran past him, or, you know, every time Jordan Pickford makes a mistake. He hasn't got to, you know, hasn't got to apologise to anyone. Everton are in the position they're in not because of bad referees, but because of bad signing, you know, bad decisions off the pitch, bad decisions on the pitch, and, you know, as well as the trouble that they're in terms of the Premier League, we're talking about Chelsea. I mean, Everton got very close links to Usmanov, who has had his assets frozen by the EU this week, and I think they're in a very, very difficult position, Everton, and they'll be absolutely desperate, obviously, not to go down, but they look like they're in a massive relegation battle because, you know, Burnley are playing tonight and they've really stepped it up. I think Burnley will fancy their chances of getting something as well tonight.
Burnley well could. They have been on a recent good run. 2 wins, 2 draws and 1 loss in their last 5. Whereas Leicester City even have only got 2 points out of the last 5 games. But there's another team looking for a change in fortune, Mark, and that's Leeds. New manager Jesse Marsh in. Started out in America. He has a fair background, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. I think he did very well in the States, New York Red Bulls. Then he's been part of that Red Bull production for a long time. Went to Salzburg, again did well. There were high hopes for him when he went to Leipzig. I felt he had a very difficult job in Germany because Julian Nagelsmann, who departed for Bayern Munich, had sort of taken the club on to a level, and I think it was always going to be difficult to replace him. They also sold their 2 centre-backs. Konate went to Liverpool, Upamecano went to Bayern Munich. So, you know, 2 of the favourites, really, for the Champions League have taken the 2 defenders, and I think that it was just a little bit too much, really. And Marsh went into a job that was already difficult. Then they got a Champions League draw that put them in with Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain, and they were on the back foot sort of straight away in that competition. So He eventually kind of, it felt like the writing was on the wall quite early on, and he did get the sack. I wouldn't judge him too much on what happened at Leipzig. I think there was enough in the sort of the first few jobs to suggest that he is a good coach. He hasn't really worked though outside of that Red Bull production line, and you know everything is done for you with them Red Bull clubs. The scouting is spot on. The science is unbelievable, sort of seen as top of the class. You know, in so many aspects off the pitch, he's walking into a situation at Leeds that will be quite different. You know, Bielsa was so very hands-on, so very unique. The players were emotionally attached to him. So were the supporters. So it's a difficult job for him in that regard. I also think the American accent, while unfair and it shouldn't be the way, I do think that there is a stigma associated with that. I mean, Bob Bradley, when he came into the Premier League, was laughed out of town pretty quickly. So I think it's important for Marsh that he gets off to a good start, because, like I said, the fans, the players, they're all still attached to Bielsa. And if Marsh doesn't start well, it's going to be difficult for him, but he's certainly somebody I think that deserves, you know, an opportunity to manage in the Premier League. It's just, this isn't the easiest one you could get, I don't think.
Yeah, certainly, and I suppose there is going to be some lazy opinions I mentioned yesterday that will ask, why not Big Sam, why not Alan Curbishley, or nonsense like this. But yeah, we'll be interesting to see how Jesse gets on. Mark, before we do let you go, there's a few FA Cup ties this evening. Peterborough welcome Manchester City. Obviously, the headline there is Alexander Zinchenko is set to play. Pep said he is in the right frame of mind to play a professional football match. So, you know, hopefully it goes well for Alexander. Crystal Palace and Stoke. But Middlesbrough Spurs, I suppose, talking about managers and managers under pressure, Antonio Conte, obviously, listen, we've talked about it at Lent already, and him coming out and giving very impassioned speeches and being very honest. But listen, he's won the FA Cup as Chelsea manager already. Is this the perfect distraction from a frustrating league run to try and progress in the Cup? And they'll be coming up against Chris Wilder in Middlesbrough, which will be a dogged opponent. We've seen them already knock out Manchester United.
Yeah, I mean, it's an awkward game. There's no doubt about that. A way to, you know, a very good championship team and a very good manager. But I think Antonio Conte will see the FA Cup as, you know, as the opportunity to end that Tottenham sort of trophy drought. But as he himself pointed out, you look at that final on Sunday between Liverpool and Chelsea. In England, even if you get to the quarterfinal or the semi-final, you're probably going to have to beat two of the best teams in Europe to win a trophy. So it's not easy. They will expect to go through tonight. I think if they play like they did against Man City and Leeds, there won't be any problems. The ultimate thing is, though, can they beat two of them big guns, or even one? You know, and that's not easy. And, you know, it's probably going to be another season, I would say, without a trophy for Tottenham. But the more important is to try to get top four. And I still think that they're very much in that race with Arsenal and Manchester United. I don't see a sort of standout team between those three. It's probably going to, you know, go right to the last couple of weeks and the matches between the teams that are still to come, vital. I'm not saying Tottenham are favourites, but you'd fancy them more for top four, I think, than to win the FA Cup.
Yeah, someone will eventually crawl over the line, I think, into fourth place. Paul Corrie, there was a full billing of League of Ireland fixtures last night. I know you were out in Talla to watch the Jack Byrne show. Rovers defeating Drogheda 3-1. Bowes got a good Dublin Derby victory over Pats 1-0. Dundalk 3-0. Winners over Finn Harps. Derry Sligo was nil-all, as was a brutal 90 minutes in the Belfield Bowl between UCD and Shells. But let's start in Talla. You were out there, 3-1 victors, and as I mentioned, I suppose it's all about Jack Byrne.
Yeah, you asked me, I think about 2 weeks ago, Shane, what was I most looking forward to, and I said Jack Byrne. It wasn't the most unique of answers, but he certainly proved last night why he brings so much attention to himself and to Shamrock.
That's why you're paid the big bucks, Paul.
I'm not sure about that. But it was a masterclass last night, and I don't mean a masterclass in the sense that he was super for 90 minutes. There's certainly elements of his game that are going to improve with the more minutes that he gets. He hasn't played a lot of football in the last 12-18 months, having been out in Cyprus, and then he had an operation on his back. But there were one or two instances, particularly the first and the second goal, which just earmarked him out as just being a cut above everything else in this league. The first goal, for anybody who hasn't seen, he's just received on the half turn, and the ball inside the fullback for Sean Gannon to get onto was just inch perfect. And it was one where the majority of players, Shane, would play that wide into Gannon's feet. He just has so much imagination to reverse the ball inside the fullback. Great touch from Sean Gannon and a good finish. And then his own goal was actually a good Rovers move, and it's something they didn't do enough of in the game. They were patient in their approach play. They moved it from left to right, and Jack, in my opinion, is at his best when he's sitting in that gap between, say, Drogheda's back four in the midfield, and he's picked up the ball. It was a nice little threaded ball from Andy Lyons. Jack gets it out of his feet 20-25 yards out, and it just had a sense of inevitability. You know, his technique is so clean, and he caught the ball so flush, and it's moved a bit, and Colly McCabe couldn't get his hands anywhere near it. So Jack Byrne was ultimately, you know, the difference between the two sides. There are certainly gears for Shamrock Rovers to go through, Shane. There's certainly improvement in that side, but the way, you know, it weighs up, they didn't really need to get out of second gear yesterday against Drogheda.
Yeah, certainly. And with Derry drawing with Sligo as well, I suppose that would be very beneficial to Shamrock Rovers. Just before we do let you go, Paul Bowes, Pats 1-0, Stephen Mallon with the goal. Keith Long will be pleased to get the win after a draw with Dundalk. Obviously, their first match was postponed against Sligo. So good for Keith Long, good for Bowes. Bit worrying for Tim Clancy and Pats?
Well, big win for Bowes, first and foremost. I think themselves and Sligo have had excellent starts, playing Dundalk and then playing Pats. I think if you'd offered Keith Long 4 points out of those two fixtures, you would have bitten your hand off it. There probably were major question marks in around Bowes and their back four, and how it would actually line up, having lost some key personnel and the spine of the team maybe being taken out with key people leaving. But they've started well. I thought they would look solid as a back four, and given the way they played last year, they're always within a chance, or they will always create chances that will ultimately win games. It was a really poor mistake from Scott at right back. He's let the ball bounce twice, and Stephen Mallon has latched onto it, and it was a good finish. He is somebody who you can probably expect a bit more from. He's been unlucky with injuries over the last two seasons, so if they can keep him fit with the likes of Ali Cook, Twardek, Omisher, there is certainly goals within that Bowes team, and maybe not yes time to panic if you're Tim Clancy. I think if you go back to the President's Cup game against Shamrock Rovers, Pats looked good, but last night they didn't really look as threatening as they did in the President's Cup game and the Shells game. Important game coming up this Friday against Shamrock Rovers that they need to bounce back from. A lot of change, Stevie O'Donnell leaving, the likes of Lee Desmond leaving, big holes to fill. It's going to take maybe Tim Clancy 2 or 3 weeks before he gets his recipe and his comfortable 11 that he wants to work with. But they certainly need to just start picking up a couple of points and maybe drawing some of those games as opposed to losing them.
Okay, good stuff. Lots to look forward to. Shinne for football. Mark Langdon, thank you very much. Paul Corry, thank you very much. Hurling is up next.
RTE 2FM. Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Being flat to the mat isn't real. Our protein is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on. Hurling.
Now it is time to turn our attention to hurling. Niall Moran joins us now. And Niall, great weekend of hurling, has to be said. I suppose only one place to start: Limerick, Cork. Cork 9-point winners, just 6 months after they were defeated by 16 points in the All-Ireland final. And now, of course, the two teams will be meeting in Munster in just 7 weeks' time. It's 3 defeats from 3 now in the league for Limerick, and Cork's 3rd victory in a row following wins over Clare and Offaly. What did you make of it as a spectacle? That's before we'll get into the aggression and the possible ill-discipline and whatnot. But from a hurling perspective, what did you make of it?
You couldn't but be impressed by Cork. Look, they were superb in the first half. They're used to the wind. Like, look, they went in, what were they, 14 points up there at half time, and probably even less scores behind them thereafter. Look, I suppose even we would have said at the time last year, so the All Ireland final, like, look, it was kind of a malfunctioning Cork team. And I suppose, unfortunately for them, they didn't get a chance until now, maybe to kind of turn the tables a little bit. And I suppose, look, they had a winter of discontent there, having to put up with the barrage of abuse, and I suppose that was kind of the icing on the cake. There was the lack of an all-star, which, look, anyone here in Limerick would have said that was extremely harsh. So, look, Cork had to come to Limerick with something on Sunday, and I suppose the argument that was made against them in the corresponding league fixture last year, Limerick had swatted them away in the first half, and I suppose this today, like I said, or Sunday, there were 14 points in at half time. And probably the really encouraging thing from a Cork perspective was they found new players like Kieran Joyce is really cementing himself this year throughout the league, and you would imagine he'd be a championship starter. Even Dara Leary knew into it there. At full back did very, very well, and defensively overall Cork was set up far better. They exploited Limerick across the board and they're full value for their win in the end.
Niall, you were saying there Cork have found some new players. John Kiley was looking for some as well, but by half time he was going back to the old brigade.
Yeah, that, and probably Ruby, that was the most, probably been the most disheartening aspect of this year's league. Look, again, there's probably being a fan in the stadium the last day, there's probably a sense of nostalgia. So a famous Limerick slang word, the word gowl. It was used on multiple occasions, brandished at the ref as normal, but sometimes it was brandished at some of our own players. And look, I heard from Limerick for a long time, and trust me, my group were on the back of those kind of beatings quite often, so I'm not going to jump on the brigade and start slating lads, because I know how difficult it is when you're against the tide. But I suppose, look, the fearful thing for Limerick is maybe the gap between the 15 and 16 who probably have carried Limerick to All-Ireland success over the last 3 or 4 years, and the gap to the guys thereafter. It seems to be a bit of a chasm with it. And I suppose, look, the longevity of any of these really, really teams that stay at the top for 7, 8, 9 years, i.e. Kenny and Hurling, Dublin and football, there has been a couple of guys who have, every year, every second year, there's a couple of new guys coming into the equation. And I suppose maybe the fear for Limerick is that the guys who have started maybe in Ulster's All-Ireland, I don't think any of them are going to be under the pressure for their place. And that's not meant as a slight on the guys who came in from the cold after him. Like, you have to give guys a credit, like Robbie Hanley, Colin Coughlin, Colin Neal. They all did well in patches. But I suppose the expectation when you're playing for the All-Ireland champions is that the level is at the ultimate best. And I suppose what that then does is it doesn't allow lads to settle in. So, look, that was probably the most discouraging thing. And part of me thinks, look, I know John Kiley, the results were slipping away from him. You had to do something. But a part of me would also think that maybe you just right to leave him there, leave him sweat it out. The wind is going to be behind their back in the second half. I would have probably just left them there, because ultimately you've probably set them back a good bit by taking them off, where at least they saw it out. Who knows, a couple of them, like, they might have improved their performance. And even Colin Neal, who's after getting a goal, do you know what I mean? I know obviously that the substitution was probably preordained, but like that would have given him a bit of confidence. Yeah, it was kind of, he got no kickback off it. So look, it is a worry. It is a worry, and teams are catching up. And again, look, I don't know what Limerick are doing. They looked a little bit leggy. So that is a concern, but I think everyone would have felt that teams are catching up, this year's league in particular.
Kieran Kingston felt his first half was very good, but he was disappointed to lose the second half by 5. Was that him looking at the team he played in the second half compared to the first half, or maybe thinking his own lads didn't see it out as well as they should have?
Yeah, that's like you being disappointed, Ruby, about not lapping other horses with a horse that's after winning in a canter. Look, I suppose every manager, you have to try and quench the hype and everything else that's going to surround the team, and so that was his way of doing it. I wouldn't read a whole pile into it. Look, he'll have went home really happy, because again, I'm coming back to that league fixture last year. Limerick obliterated Cork in the first half of that fixture. He even put huge pressure under Patrick Collins, whereas I think the reverse probably happened on Sunday. So he'll be delighted. And again, the fact you found a couple, and I suppose a huge thing for Cork was Jerry Mellerick kind of falling in that kind of deep lying role. Do you know what I mean? Kieran Joyce kind of going back to the half back, and the return to form of Darragh Fitzgibbon, like in the All-Ireland final last year, and probably even the games coming up to it, Darragh Fitzgibbon just went through an awful slump in form. But ultimately, he is one of the top midfielders in the country. And do you know what I mean? There was times there in the first half, especially on Sunday, where you couldn't lay a glove on him. Like, and he finished up there with, do you know what I mean? He had 2 or 3 points there. He was unmarkable. So that'd be huge. That'd be huge kind of element of confidence for Cork.
What about the atmosphere on the pitch then? Anthony Daly likened it to Clare and the Tipperary in the 90s, the bad blood on the pitch. Is discipline going to be key when these meet in the Munster Championship?
It was lively in the stand. Jesus, lively in the stand, Ruby. I said there was a couple of minutes there behind.
Not too many fellas getting chucked out of the stand now. Are going to have much influence on the result, all the same.
Yeah, there was, I don't know, maybe, I think there was a couple of Limerick supporters in my area that had sharp memories of what's gone for a long time. And again, look, I thought on the pitch, look, there was going to be a bit of narkiness in it. I know Caddy had come out earlier in the week, he said, like, just there has to be a bit of a bad guy in all of us. And Cork had to discover that, like, they're a little bit naive, thinking that you're going to go toe-to-toe and hurling and athleticism alone and win matches. Yeah, and I think you just saw that the last day. They crowded into zones, and huge, biggest thing that they wanted was big turnovers. And I suppose when you have turnovers, you want to have altercation. And yeah, look, there was a couple of late tackles. So I suppose, look, Shane Kingston, I don't know, was there huge intent in it? But again, obviously, the nature of it, it was a sending off. And look, from a Limerick perspective, it's for Seamus to get sent off. John Snyder's first time. Again, like a superb hurler, pivotal to that team. But they needed just things to settle down and kind of maintain a full 4-15. And you know, that was probably inexcusable. And that would be a huge force of ire to John, especially maybe after Giroud sending off. Because obviously against Galway, that altered the game. But again, any chance Limerick had of making a comeback, they weren't going to do it with 14-14.
Yeah, there certainly was a bit of bite to it. And from a neutral perspective, I cannot wait until they meet again in the Munster Championship, as I said, in just 7 weeks' time. But that wasn't the only match this weekend, of course. Also in 1A, Galway against Wexford. Wexford 2-15 winners over Galway, 15 points. Two new managers, but I suppose the question I'll pose to you, Niall, might Dara Egan be the best managerial appointment across hurling this year, because Wexford continuing a perfect start to the league?
Yeah, he's definitely settling in with a plum anyway. Look, he's huge experience. He's on the line for Tip for the last 4 or 5 years. He was part of an All-Ireland winning group. So, it was a very, very shrewd appointment. Again, young coach, young manager, principal of a primary school just up the road here. He's doing really well. And I suppose the really encouraging thing for Wexford is he's probably 8 or 9 lads of under 20 age. Lads we might necessarily have kind of heard a whole pile about, and thereafter coming in to integrate into the team. And probably what you're going to find is the likes of the Kieran McDonalds and even Lee Chin when he comes back, they're all going to have to earn their place. And again, I suppose, look, obviously Oisín Pepper, a young lad there, I think he's sitting leaving cert. So I mean, he got a goal and a point there when he came on, huge addition. But I suppose Rory O'Connor will be pivotal for them. And I know against Clare he was just unmarkable there in the first half. And again, he showed huge elements of that the last day. So maybe, like I said, the nature of how they play, like they were well organised under Davey, love them or loathe them, they were very, very well organised. But I suppose what they're probably finding is they're altering that play a little bit and they have targets inside. And again, like if a guy like Rory O'Connor, he's going to take watching with space in front of him. So all credit to Barry Egan, he's made a huge start. And really, I think that win over Galway on Sunday would be a lot more encouraging to him even than maybe winning against Limerick and Clare, because John Gall is a hard place to go to get a win. Tight pitch, wind going down the pitch normally, and Wexford just simply out hurled Galway. And do you know what I mean? I suppose, look, Henry isn't going to worry just yet. There's still a huge return to form. Some of the older guys, Gerard Mack again, was very, very good. But as I said, Wexford are now putting their hand into the hat, and Leinster is getting very interesting as we move along, especially with Dublin coming as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, Galway, we'll be interested to see how they respond to that defeat, a tough challenge of Cork next week. One other match in 1A, a fairly one-sided Clare 4-20, Offaly 16 points. I suppose the return of Tony Kelly scoring 2-12, 1-5 from play was probably the headline news from that one. Certainly pleasing for Brian Lowen and the boys down there, and tough work for Offaly to go on. But turning our attention to 1B, you mentioned Dublin there, Niall. Tipperary versus Dublin last weekend. Matty Kenny's Dublin withstood a late Tipperary fight back to claim the points down at Semple Stadium. Ryan McBride and Ronan Hayes scoring goals either side of the break for the Dubs, and they maintained their 2022 unbeaten record. And I suppose there was little sign of, we were speaking about it the week previous with Shane McGrath kind of in the preview, there was little sign of Tip's new flowing short game under Colin Bonner, with the Dubs dominating the physical and breaking ball contests. And that's something that must be extremely pleasing for Matty Kenny.
Yeah, I suppose, look, for Tipperary, again, we spoke about it before, the criticism of Liam Sheedy's later tenure was that he hadn't integrated new guys into it. And so was maybe other criticisms might have centred around that they probably stayed traditional to what Tip do best, in allowing their skills and physicality kind of dictate play. So, like, you have to give Colin Bonner credit. He's integrated guys. Do you know what I mean? I suppose even like, you look at the backs there, like Connolly, Brian McGrath, Morgan, like John Deep, Robert Byrne. Like, they're all very inexperienced guys, so like, you have to give credit to him. He's given them their head. And secondly, then, like, they're trying to change their style. They're adapting to what's popular there at the moment. And like, to be fair, look, that's a very, very good Dublin team who recently have a very good track record against Tipperary in Thurles. So, like, do you know what I mean? Tip won't be overly despondent by that defeat. Do you know what I mean? They're improving as they go. And again, like, do you know what I mean? Jake Morris showed huge potential there. Jason Ford, again, very, very prominent. But look, Tip are, they have, it's going to take time for these guys to bed in. And they, on the other side, Dublin have been hugely impressive. Probably understated. I think you're looking at some of the wins. We're going to talk maybe about the likes of Cork, how impressive they are at Wexford. But Dublin are quietly eking away. Like, they had an excellent Waterford team above in Dublin, drew with them in a cracker of a game, beat Tipperary away. Like, you know what I mean? They were excellent in the Welsh Cup. And I suppose, really, for Dublin, like, you had no Liam Rush, you had no Darragh Gray, Keenball and Mark Shute. Like, all those guys are going to come back into the mixer. And when they do it, I think what you're going to find with Dublin is they're going to still have that athleticism and physicality as they've always had. But I think we're seeing maybe the impact of Dublin's rise in prominence in the early, say, 2010s, in the sense that guys have more hurling, they have more stick work. Like, Jolene Donald, Burke, Ree McBride, Ron Hayes, Fergal Whiteley, these boys are, they're stickmen. And you know, I suppose when they were knocking on the door for an All-Ireland, maybe around 13, they probably just lacked one or two players with that little bit of finesse. Whereas I think maybe now we're beginning to see it. And like, Leinster is going to be so interesting. Like, you to have three of either of Seagal or Wexford, Kenny or Dublin, and okay, Offaly as well coming into the mix. Like, it'll be really interesting to see who loses out in that one.
I'm a stickler for form, and I know it can be hard to get a handle on form through the league, but just going with Dublin and Waterford, they obviously drew and they both beat Antrim by 4 points, Dublin or Waterford, last weekend. So if you're judging Dublin off Waterford, are you making a really strong case for them?
Yeah, I am making a strong case for them, because again, like, Matty Kenny is a very shrewd guy, and again, there have been question marks over the winter whether he's going to return to his position, whether, do you know what I mean, results would have dictated that he was there. But like, you're seeing like a huge improvement in them. I suppose probably what would concern them is they're 5 points up with kind of a breeze behind them, maybe 20 minutes left. You would expect that they'd kicked on with 10 minutes left, they're still only 5 points up. They left Tipperary in the game. And again, maybe there was a huge element to that against Waterford as well, where they left a lot of scores behind them. So if they're looking for room to improve over the next couple of weeks, it'll definitely be in their execution of their possession, because their possession stats are kind of right through the roof there at the moment, and the nature of their play, they're very, very well coached, very well drilled. So I suppose ultimately for them to move into the real pack, I suppose maybe from the top of the third tier into the real second tier, who are going to challenge for Leinster and All-Ireland, they'll have to execute more of those chances.
Waterford obviously did beat Antrim at the weekend. They're tipping along, but nothing more than you would have expected, or I would have expected anyway.
Yeah, no, they're still savagely impressive. Like, do you know what I mean? They went up to Carrigan Park there. So all things change when you're going into a place like that. It's a really hard place to get a win. And look, they were fairly cruising in the first half too. Like, even the last Colin Dunford, he had a couple of goals got at that point. And do you know what I mean? I suppose they kind of stagnated a little bit, left centrum in the game. And again, only for Sean O'Brien made a brilliant save there from a penalty. The game could have been very different, but like, again, maybe a part of me there thinks, like, even there you're brushing over maybe Offaly, but I think we're brushing over Antrim. Like, I suppose one of the most true disappointments that seems to be over the last couple of years, do you know what I mean, was Darren Gleeson's appointment as Antrim manager. Like, he's getting a twist off them consistently for the last couple of years, like, and that's all credit to him. And I suppose, look, further down the road, his own county might be looking for him back in a couple of years' time, because he's shown himself to be very, very good tactically, and he seems to have all the best hurlers in Antrim playing. And look, the unfortunate thing for him is that the results aren't going with their performances. So, yeah.
You know, you said we brushed over Offaly, but there were 14 points apiece at half time, and they ended up getting hammered.
They did, Ruby, yeah, they did, but like, geez, like, again, I don't know much about horses, I won't claim to, but do you know what I mean?
I know very little about hurling, but his horse is 16 points to 420.
Yeah, and I know, but you're better than I am, but no, again, like, do you know what I mean? I suppose it's a horse stepping up the grades. Like, you know, you have a grade 3 winner going into a grade 1, it's totally different. Like, and again, when we look at Offaly, we tend to empathise with the great Offaly team of yonder, but like, this is the team, look, they're on the rise, you're just going to have to be patient. And ultimately, look, Mick Fenley, I say he was counting his lucky stars that Tony Kelly returned, the one player who didn't want returning at that point, and like, he just ignited there in the second half, and look, they took off there, they got a goal early in the second half, and that kind of, it was like 9 points apiece at half time, they got a goal early doors, And look, the wind just went out of Offaly. Do you know what I mean? But look, Clare as well, I know we're kind of brushing over them. You have to look at the players that Clare are coming back there. Tony Kelly is back, Peter Duggan is back, Shane Meehan, who was a dual star at minor level a couple of years ago. This guy is really, really exciting. Mark Rogers lit up the Fitzgibbon for late, or for UL before he got injured. Clare are going to have serious forwards, they're going to have serious midfield. And if they can just get things right in terms of the backs and maybe puck out restarts, they're going to be a serious opposition. And like, you know, Limerick, I think, are going to meet a different team on Sunday going into Ennis than what they met in the Munster League final, because, do you know what I mean, they've sensed a little bit of blood. They know that Limerick's confidence might be the way it should be. And if Clare could get a big performance, who knows, even a win, that would do wonders for them.
Shane, I'm sorry. I know we swore we wouldn't mention Clare without Marie, but we had to.
Ah, sure, look, Ruby. I'm sure she'll forgive us. Marie will be back tomorrow anyway, Ruby. You can sort this next week. Listen, unfortunately, that is all we've time for on the hurling chat. Niall Moran, thank you very much. I'm sure we'll be chatting again in the coming weeks.
Game on.
Hurling.
RTE.
2FM.
Game on.
On 2FM. With Green Farm. Rise and grind and the hustle mindset aren't real. The protein in our chicken and turkey is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. We're going to briefly turn our attention to golf in the company of Greg Allen and Gary Murphy. And Gary, if I may start with you, at the weekend, Shane Lowry was left to bemoan the worst break of his career as he stood on the 18th tee box at the Honda Classic. When a downpour started, do professional golfers just sometimes think, why me?
All the time, Ruby. I think most golfers do. Yeah, it was a tough break. I know Shane's made history in horrendous weather. When he won as an amateur in Balltray and obviously at the Open in Portrush, but he got very unlucky on Sunday. You know, I think someone put a star. Porrick actually did a review where Straka's tee shot on 18 was the same as Berger's, and the difference was almost 70 yards just because of the weather conditions. So Shane got unlucky, but he did nothing wrong. He played unbelievably well. He'd only four bogeys all week on probably one of the toughest tests on the PGA Tour. And, you know, he's had a light schedule. It's only his fourth start, so it's a brilliant finish. Disappointing not to get the win, but really sets him up nicely for the Players' Championship next week.
And, Greg, he as much as said that when a reporter said to him, the breaks usually even themselves out. Well, hopefully, he said, mine is in 5 or 6 weeks at Augusta. That is a great mindset to take out of it.
Yeah, and it's the only mindset to take out of it, I think, as well. Look, he played great. He played a bogey-free final round of 67. He nominated 67 at the weekend to give him a chance of winning, and he shot 67, which is an awful lot better than the 77 that he shot in the final round in Abu Dhabi. So he's banished that bad experience, and he's, you know, he's jumping into some big tournaments ahead because the Players' Championship, the Masters, the World Match Play, they're all coming up. He's going to skip this week at the Arnold Palmer Invitational. The one thing I would say about this, I think it's characterised slightly unfairly for Sepp Straka, who birdied three of the last five holes. He was one under par through the infamous bear trap. He birdied 18, albeit from a huge drive in the dry conditions, and he took for ages over the second shot, which possibly was a bit questionable in the rules because you're not supposed to rest during a rain shower. Rain is something you have to play through unless there's a hooter that goes. So effectively, you know, I think Shane at best would have been in a playoff if he birdied 18, and then it's a 50-50. And Straka was playing really well. Shane had just gone a little bit off since that short miss putt early in the back nine of about 5 feet. Towards the end, he was really playing nicely, but not as on fire as he had been for the previous 27 holes. Look, at the end of the day, Shane played great. Somebody played better. Conditions intervened. It was a really tough break, but that's golf. It's a game with really tough breaks, and nobody ever said golf was fair.
I suppose, Gary, Greg mentioned there, I suppose, but the near future will hold for Shane Lowry. And listen, he was seeking his first victory since the 2019 Open. He did climb 15 spots. He's up to 35th now in the World Golf Rankings after that second place finish at the weekend. So, I mean, that's what now, five consecutive top 25 finishes worldwide. So he's on an upward curve, it's fair to say.
He played really nicely in the Middle East. Obviously, as Greg alluded to, he had a bad final day in Abu Dhabi. That can happen. It was very disappointing, but he played lovely in Dubai and in Saudi as well. He didn't hole any putts. He putted a lot better last week. But it's a big shot in the arm to him as well, because he's starting very late. That's only his fourth start in the PGA Tour, and they're over 40% through their season. So it's a big shot in the arm for him, and will give him renewed hope for what is going to be a huge month coming up, which hopefully, you know, he's got to be thinking majors, because he's, you know, the golf he played at the weekend, I thought his rhythm was just amazing. I think it's the best tempo I've seen him swing since Bull Rush, so hopefully he can keep that going. And obviously Rory's the headline act this week, but Shane will rest up and get ready for the Players. And, you know, it's a big move up to FedEx as well. He was miles down. He was 220, I think, so he's up to 46, so it's all good news for Shane Lowry.
And Greg, Shane obviously spent the majority of last year concentrating on qualifying for that Ryder Cup team. Do you think with a change of focus this year he can be a player at the majors?
Oh look, I think Shane has now elevated himself. I think the experience of the Ryder Cup last year was critical to his career, because it gave him another high point other than the Open Championship victory at Portrush. He drove all the way towards the Ryder Cup. In a losing Ryder Cup team, he actually played well. He felt a great deal of, I suppose, a sag in his motivation directly after the Ryder Cup, and why wouldn't he? But then he built it up again with that very fine finish to the season in Dubai, and now he's kicked on to the start of this season. Shane badly needs this now, a win, just to... for people to say that his last win wasn't just the Portrush Open Championship extraordinary fairy tale in wind and rain. Like, something like last week would have given him an absolute huge shot in the arm in terms of his elevation. He's won a PGA Tour event on top of the victory in Portrush, but it means that he goes into the Players' Championship and the Masters knowing he's playing well, and he is playing well. He said last week that that was about the best he struck the ball all week, in fact the best he played, because he also putted great for 63 holes. And I think that little bit of hunger that he's got from coming so close to winning is going to really drive him on. He loves Sawgrass, and I think he's grown to like Augusta, and I think he's going to be really hungry for the events coming up, knowing he's playing well and knowing he missed out on a very, very dubious piece of luck.
And Gary, what can we expect of Rory this weekend? And before we let you go, give us a tip as well. You're deadly in this golf.
No, I think Rory will do well this week. He's former champion, won there in 2018. You know, he's good record around Bay Hill. I think Will Zalatoris is very interesting. If he can putt half decent, his TG Green game is excellent. But go for Matsuyama is a decent enough place.
Unfortunately, gentlemen, Greg Allen, Gary Murphy, thank you very much for your company. We are out of time. Before I let Ruby have the last word, just time to remind our listeners that the RTE Choice Music Prize takes place this Thursday, and our very own 2FM's Dan Hegarty will broadcast a special one-hour documentary looking at some of the previous winners of Irish Album of the Year tonight at 11 p.m. here on 2FM. Over to 60 Minutes, we'll hear from last year's winner, Denise Shiloh, the very first recipient, Julie Feeney, the Russangano family, Soak, Neil Hannon of the Divine Comedy, big Neil Hannon fan, Ships, two-time winner Jape, and it also features interviews with the event host Tracy Clifford and indeed RTE Choice's Jim Carroll. So very much looking forward to that one, Ruby.
I hope you are, Shane, and enjoy your day off, because Marie is back tomorrow. No doubt you'll have Camogie and women's football. Tara Kumar's up next. Thanks a million for listening.
RTE 2FM.
On 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty.